This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, June 14th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. Lots to talk about this hour in a very tense Washington, D.C. We begin with the latest on a story of a shooting at a congressional baseball practice in Northern Virginia.
It's my breaking point of civility in politics. When you go to baseball practice for a game for charity and you have to dodge bullets and you watch your colleagues lay in the field, it's my breaking point. This has to stop. Hate has to stop.
That's U.S. Congressman Rodney Davis, who was at the Virginia baseball practice when a shooter, identified as James T. Hodgkinson, opened fire. He's now deceased. House Majority Leader Steve Scalise was shot and injured. Scalise is reported to be in stable condition, and at least four others were injured in the shooting as well. The president delivered a statement to the American people shortly after the incident.
Congressman Scalise is a friend, and a very good friend. He's a patriot, and he's a fighter. He will recover from this assault. And Steve, I want you to know that you have the prayers not only of the entire city behind you, but of an entire nation and, frankly, the entire world.
The president's tone was striking, quite unlike the emotional calls for an end to gun violence and reining in their availability that we heard during the 8 years of the Obama administration. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick has been following this situation from D.C. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
Boy, it was pretty scary there in the very beginning.
It was from the early morning hours this morning, about 10 past 7, when the first 911 calls came to police in the Delray section of Alexandria, Virginia. So we're talking just across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C., and down the road a little bit. And that baseball practice that you're hearing about is for an annual congressional baseball game, scheduled, by the way, to take place tomorrow in the Washington Nationals baseball stadium, since the Nationals are on the road right now. It takes place every year. It's for charity. It's Republicans versus Democrats. Members of Congress take it fairly seriously, but there's also a lot of camaraderie and everybody goes out to the game and enjoys it. And this morning, of course, practice for the Republicans interrupted by gunfire. House Majority Whip Steve Scalise was standing near second base, taking grounders and fielding. Now, I talked to an eyewitness of this account, who's Congressman Rodney Davis. You played him in the intro. He's from Illinois. Rodney Davis was up to bat while Steve Scalise and other members of Congress were in the field. And here's what Rodney Davis said.
I looked out, said something, and the next thing I heard was, "Everybody run, he's got a gun." And we immediately ran and got into the dugout. And then from there, many of us dispersed to even safer areas.
John, when I spoke to Rodney Davis in Statuary Hall in the Capitol, he had returned from the ball field. He was still wearing his sports cleats and shorts and a dusty T-shirt from the ball field. He had some blood on his arm, a superficial wound from fleeing or diving in the dugout. He wasn't sure. And he described the scene a little bit more.
And somebody recognizes that we're being shot at. Somebody says run, and you don't stand around and ask why they're telling you that. Got in the dugout. We dispersed out of the dugout. Many of us did. I did. Went behind other cover, and then eventually moved across the street behind covers and cars. Then there was somebody said he's coming around the corner of the field. So we, three of us, immediately ran up the sidewalk between two apartment buildings, and a Good Samaritan saw us running and said, "Come in." And we went in. And that's when I was able to call my wife. That's when I was able to call my kids and also call 911 before that.
How vulnerable are Congress people, and how much of that is the discussion right now?
That's a big part of the discussion, of course, going on among members of Congress and reporters and staffers. A lot of downcast eyes, grim-faced people on the Hill today, John, including Capitol Police officers. When I arrived on the Hill this morning for work, before we knew that the two officers who had been injured were going to be okay and the staffers were going to be okay, and it looks like Whip Scalise was going to be okay, there were a lot of really nervous people. Now, you ask how vulnerable they are. there were Capitol Police on hand, we know for sure, because Steve Scalise, as House Majority Whip, has a detail with him at all times, a Capitol Police security detail. Most members of Congress do not have any type of detail like that, unless they're in leadership or unless they receive specific threats to their safety, which does happen fairly frequently. Now, it is common, they don't talk about it much in the media, but it is common for members of Congress to receive briefings from the Capitol Police, intelligence updates. If they receive any kind of threat to themselves or their family, they're instructed to inform the Capitol Police, and they're given instructions on how to vary their routines, how to increase their safety. I spoke with Gerald Nadler this morning here on Capitol Hill, John. He's a member of Congress from New York City. And I asked him whether incidents like this, and there have been others, make him and other members of Congress feel like it's time for more security.
Look, you can't protect everybody all the time. It's a risk for anybody. And it's a condition of life in the modern world.
Although the idea that someone's going to just open fire on a baseball field bespeaks, you know, who is this individual? I mean, there are certainly characters and profiles that we can think of who are either, you know, lone wolves or terrorists. No one's described this as terrorism. Did anyone get a chance to speak with James Hodgkinson before he died? I saw two of the law enforcement briefings, and there was no information there.
John, Congressman Jeff Duncan told reporters, now he was at the practice early and left early, so he showed up for batting practice and then left. He told reporters that he spoke to a man in the parking lot, and that man asked him if the players on the field were Republicans or Democrats. Jeff Duncan says he told the man they were Republicans, and then he thanked him, and then they walked away. Jeff Duncan believes that that man, now that he's seen his picture, James Hodgkinson, on television, believes he was the shooter. Now, that was their exchange. That doesn't necessarily go to it goes to motive, but that doesn't describe potentially the shooter's full motive. We just don't know that yet. Police have not briefed reporters on any kind of full motive, if they have one. James Hodgkinson's Facebook page contains a lot of political messages. Many of them are pro Bernie Sanders. There's some anti-Trump messages, political in nature, not violent, at least not that I've seen. Some anti-Hillary Clinton, again, political, just not liking Hillary Clinton, but not violent, that I've seen on his Facebook page. So all of that may go to motive, but nobody has announced that yet. And when you get back also to the question of this type of violence against members of Congress, as shocking as it is, we have to remember it's far from the first time that things like this have happened. This immediately brings to mind the shooting of Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords in 2011,
right,
in Tucson, when she was holding a campaign event or a meet and greet event, I should say, not a campaign event, where she was shot through the head. Staffers died in that attack with an assailant in the parking lot. There have been other incidents as well. People around here today also remembering an incident, John, that's commemorated here on Capitol Hill every year, when an assailant entered the door of the Capitol itself and shot dead two Capitol Police officers before trying to make his way to the office of then Congressional Leader Tom DeLay.
Remember it very well. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
You bet, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. Lots to talk about this hour. And we are, of course, following that Virginia shooting at a baseball field that has injured one congressman, Steve Scalise, a Republican from Louisiana, as well as several congressional aides and Capitol Police. Todd Zwillick will have more on that coming up. But we begin with the Capitol Hill drama that has enveloped the U.S. government since before the inauguration. If James Comey, as a private citizen testifying last week before the Senate Intelligence Committee, looked like the Lone Ranger, then this week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions looked like the Riddler.
Did you have any communication with any Russian businessmen or any Russian nationals?
I don't believe I had any conversation with Russian businessmen or Russian nationals.
Are you aware
Although
of any communication?
A lot of people were at the convention. It's conceivable that somebody
sir,
came
sir,
up
I have
to me.
Just a few.
Will you let me qualify it? If I don't qualify it, you'll accuse me of lying. So I need to be correct as best I can.
I do want you to be honest.
And I'm not able to be rushed this fast. It makes me nervous.
The central premise of Sessions' testimony was that on the one hand, he can't speak about anything concerning conversations he may have had with the president, and that his much-discussed recusal from the entire Russian hacking, influence, and collusion investigation is just a minor administrative detail.
Many have suggested that my recusal is because I felt I was a subject of the investigation myself, that I may have done something wrong, but this is the reason I recused myself. I felt I was required to, under the rules of the Department of Justice, and as a leader of the Department of Justice, I should comply with the rules, obviously.
For a good part of the more than two-hour testimony, Sessions either couldn't recall or refused to answer questions.
I do not have any recollection.
I do not remember.
I don't recall it.
I just don't remember it.
I don't have any recollection, but I still do not recall it.
Was he invoking executive privilege? A frustrated Senator Martin Heinrich of New Mexico couldn't get an answer on that one.
You took an oath. You raised your right hand here today, and you said that you would solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And now you're not answering questions. You're impeding this investigation. There is no appropriateness bucket. It is not a legal standard. Can you tell me what are these longstanding DOJ rules that protect conversations made in the executive without invoking executive privilege?
But it was a persistent Democratic Senator Ron Wyden who got the Attorney General really frustrated.
Mr. Comey said that there were matters with respect to the recusal that were problematic and he couldn't talk about them. What are they?
Why don't you tell me? There are none, Senator Wyden. There are none. I can tell you that for absolute certainty. This is a secret innuendo being leaked out there about me, and I don't appreciate it.
Roy L. Austin, Jr. is a partner at Harris, Wiltshire, and Grannis, and former U.S. Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice from 2010 to 2014. He joins us now. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Is this the way an attorney general typically responds to oversight from the Senate?
Well, first of all, in demeanor, I just found him defensive and constantly defensive. None of the questions were a surprise. He obviously knew what this was about. But I also found him shockingly unprepared and found the whole thing kind of amateurish. You know what the questions are going to be. You have an opportunity to talk to your counsel, the Department of Justice, to White House counsel, and you provide what, by my count, was about 25 I don't knows or I don't recalls when you even were trying to answer the question.
I described him as the Riddler at the top of this broadcast. And, you know, he does set up some things which legally I wonder if you could decipher. Is it true that he can't talk about anything that relates to a conversation with the president?
Absolutely not true. And I want to note he was contradictory about that because Senator Burr asked him specifically about that and said something like, you couldn't have had a conversation with the president about the investigation because you were never briefed on it. And he said that is correct. But then every time he was asked by a Democratic senator about those same conversations, he said, well, I can't talk about it. And then they asked him, well, what is the legal basis for you not being able to talk about it? He said, well, the president may at some point exercise his executive privilege. Well, you know before you get there whether the president is going to do that, and it's your duty to then come prepared to the hearing and either say the president is exercising it or he is not, and I can answer your question. I note that Sessions wanted, Attorney General Sessions wanted this to be in the public, presumably so he could explain. I don't know why you want it in the public so you can say, I don't know, I don't recall, and I'm going to exercise this thing that says I can't talk even though I don't really know whether I can or cannot.
In his opening statement, he emphasized collusion. He thinks, apparently, that collusion with the Russians is the only issue here, and or at least the one that relates to him. Is he correct in that?
Absolutely not. That's the only issue. That's certainly one of the issues here. But it's the entire relationship between the United States and Russia. It's the idea that Russia could have interfered with our election, or in fact, basically, as every intelligence agency has apparently said, Russia definitely did interfere. You would think as Attorney General, as someone who is up for Attorney General, as someone who is on the president-elect at the time foreign relations team, he would actually have at least a little bit of curiosity about Russia's possible role in influencing or at least trying to influence our election.
On the question of the firing of James Comey, I have a couple of things to ask about that, but your impressions of his account of how that went down.
My impression is that this man is possibly the worst boss ever. And I say that because, first of all, James Comey has served this country repeatedly and has done so honorably. And yet you're going to claim that he had some kind of problem with his own employees at the FBI and never once have a conversation with him about that to say, hey, you know, Director Comey, hey James, maybe we can do something to fix that relationship you have with your people in the FBI. Well, we all know that that was completely fabricated and untrue. The second thing is Comey comes to him and says, the president is having these conversations with me that I'm not comfortable with. And then Sessions puts that entirely on James Comey. Well, it's Sessions' job to go to the president and say, Mr. President, you cannot be having these types of conversations with the FBI director. And beyond that, he absolutely should have said to James Comey, well, what exactly were these conversations? And according to the testimony yesterday, he never even tried to find out what the conversations were that made Director Comey uncomfortable.
Am I wrong, or did the Attorney General try to have us believe yesterday that he was never briefed, there was never any discussion of Comey's massive incompetence within the FBI, and then all of a sudden, when he was approached by the president or someone else about the firing of James Comey, that he said, oh yeah, we knew that was going to happen?
You know, and actually Rod Rosenstein noted that back on May 8th, I believe it is, he knew that the president was planning to fire Director Comey. Well, how did Rod Rosenstein know this? And we know that Sessions was at that meeting. You do not fire the FBI director without saying, well, you know, Mr. President, why do you want to fire him? And according to him, he never had that conversation. And you know this is pretext. You absolutely know this is pretext, because not once in Rosenstein's letter does he mention that there's some kind of internal dissension within the FBI, which is the thing that then Sessions cited. Well, where does Sessions get that from? The entire testimony yesterday was largely a waste of time, beyond the fact that it showed how amateurish, how incoherent Attorney General Sessions is.
Now, this isn't a partisan question, is it? I mean, you're not just saying that because you worked for a Democratic president.
You know, I worked for a Democratic president, but I am someone who truly believes in the Department of Justice. I was in the Department of Justice under Republican and under Democratic presidents. And I really and truly, I love the institution that is the Department of Justice. And I love the idea that it is seeking the truth and it is seeking justice. I feel that what this president has done and what this attorney general is doing to that institution is unforgivable. And that is why I'm troubled by it. I don't care whether you're a Democrat or you are a Republican. First of all, if you have oversight and you're asked to come and testify in front of Congress, you tell the truth and you come there prepared to do so. Secondly, you don't fire the director of the FBI, the single most important investigative agency in the Department of Justice, without having a thorough review of the reasons why you're doing it. And you don't do it for pretextual reasons and try to pass that by the American public.
Finally, it seems as though Attorney General Sessions regards his recusal from the Russia investigation as just simply following some, a rule in the employee's manual at the Department of Justice, that it's not an indication in any way that he is involved in any of this. Number one, is that true? And number two, as a result of this testimony, is Sessions out of the line of fire, do you think?
I certainly do not think he is done answering questions here in any way, shape, or form. Again, this is why this was so kind of unbelievable. He says that from the moment he walked into the Attorney General's office, he treated this whole Russian thing as though he was recused. Well, that's absolutely not true, because you don't have this kind of casual, I'm recused. You have to announce it to people that you are, in fact, recused, and then there are steps that are taken to make sure the information doesn't come to you. It took him 3 weeks, 3 weeks to recuse himself, and it wasn't until people identified the fact that in response to Senator Franken's questions, he was less than honest. It wasn't until that point that he decided he had to recuse himself. If he knew from the beginning he was recusing himself because he made some promise to Senator Feinstein, then he would have done so in a formal fashion from the moment he walked through that door.
Roy L. Austin Jr. is a partner at Harris, Wiltshire & Granis and a former U.S. Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice from 2010 to 2014. Roy Austin, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Attorney General Sessions did have some defenders at the hearing yesterday. Here's Republican Senator from Oklahoma, James Langford, recalling the Obama years, and Attorney General Eric Holder.
It seems to be a short memory about some of the statements Eric Holder would and would not make to any committee in the House or the Senate, and would or would not turn over documents, even requested, that had to go all the way through the court system to finally the courts having to say, no, the president can't hold back documents and the attorney general can't do that. So somehow some accusation that you're not saying every conversation about everything. There's a long history of attorney generals standing beside the president saying there are some conversations that are confidential.
Remember, we always want to hear your take. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, especially if you've had conversations with the president. Way back in the early 1970s, I can remember those days, Hollywood top production teams for big movie makers like Paramount and Fox were made up of almost exclusively men until Marcia Nassiter, now 91, was the first female vice president of production in Hollywood. Marcia gained respect as a pioneer in the business for her work on films like Carrie, Coming Home, Apocalypse Now, and Rocky, yet she's largely unknown outside of the biz. A new documentary on the festival circuit now, A Classy Broad, wants to change all that. Takeaway producer Alexandra Botti spoke to Marcia Nassiter about her life in Hollywood, the documentary, and how she hopes serious talk of her legacy can be put off for a few more years.
Marcia Nassiter, Jewish, born in Brooklyn but raised in Texas, never planned on Hollywood. Growing up in the 30s and 40s in San Antonio, she thought of herself as a quintessential Texas kid.
What you wanted to be was like everyone else in Texas, blonde, long hair, and have a boyfriend who was a Texan, you know, drove a car, drank whiskey, and the idea of being that person was what I dreamed of, any young girl would dream of.
But a love of reading made Marcia's dreams a little bigger, bringing her first to New York to work in publishing, and then eventually to Hollywood in the 1960s, as an agent selling books to the big movie production companies. That put her squarely in an industry dominated by men.
I asked for a raise 5 years into working for Ziegler, a man named Ziggy, and he said, well, why do you need more money? He says, you're a single woman. Both my sons were then grown, and said, men have families. You don't have any families. Why should you make the same as a man? I have to tell the radio listening audience, Alexandra's eyes widened.
What did you say to that?
I quit. Unfortunately, I don't think that's always a good idea. But I could not imagine that I was not valued.
It was a risky gamble that paid off. It wouldn't be long before the movie business came knocking. She was approached by Mike Medavoy of United Artists with a job offer. Story editor.
And I said, no, I gotta be a VP.
At that time, no woman at a major movie studio had ever held the title of vice president of production. But Marcia wouldn't join United Artists unless they gave the job to her.
I think that titles are very valuable. And in Hollywood, a guy's written a script, or a director has an idea, or a producer has an idea. Well, when you're turned down by a story editor, you feel demeaned as a seller. When you're turned down by a vice president, you say, well, at least I got a real shot.
After some debate, the studio agreed and brought her on in 1974.
The chairman of United Artists, Arthur Krim, would take me and you'd come out to L.A. and we'd go to an event, and he would introduce me as our woman vice president.
In the years that followed, she helped the company usher in a string of hits. That was in large part thanks to her growing reputation as an executive with a shrewd sense of which scripts would turn into great films.
We had an incredible run. It was Rocky, Coming Home.
Captain of the football team, and I wanted to be a war hero, man. I wanted to go out and kill for my country.
Movie about Vietnam when no one was making that movie. It was a very good film, very good. Won an Oscar, won two Oscars. And the best part, as we know, is that Jane Fonda mentioned my name on the Oscars. And I went to the Oscars.
Eric Pleskow and Arthur Krim and Marcia Nassiter for getting us the money to make it.
Marcia gladly admits that her intuition was not always spot on, like when it came to picking the title for the now iconic Rocky.
I said, but the title is wrong. And everyone, of course, said, you're wrong. And we called it Rocky. I wanted to call it The Contender, which would have not brought one person into the films.
As Marcia Nassiter gained recognition in the industry, that same VP job and title opened up to more and more women, becoming known in the business as Marcia's job.
It was as if I didn't want to be a traditional woman. I guess I wanted to be like, remember Rosalind Russell in movies, who was very sophisticated? That's what I wanted to be. You know, have Cary Grant fall in love with me. That's what I wanted. But the idea that I would be a good cook, I thought was anathema to how I could succeed.
You actually say in the film that you hold women to a higher standard in filmmaking. Is that true?
Yes, because we're better than the guys. I hold them because I am a woman. That's the standard. We've all struggled to have this opportunity to get there, and we should have a higher standard.
We all know this year, we saw this wonderful movie called Hidden Figures about the women of NASA who were doing all the math and were so important to bring the first man into space.
That's Anne Gorso. She's the filmmaker behind the new documentary about Marcia's life.
Yet all these years, nobody ever mentioned their names, which is absolutely incredible. So for me, in a way, Marcia Nassiter is just like these women.
The fact that Marcia is not more of a household name outside of Hollywood troubles Gorso.
She did all the work. She made all the great choices with her great story sense. And yet, Mike Medavoy is known in a lot of places, and no one has heard of Marcia Nassiter. So to me, Marcia is the hidden figure of Hollywood.
Today, at age 91, Marcia's still working, trying to get a new film version of Huck Finn produced, a 20-year project that hasn't panned out just yet. But after all these years, she says her approach to her career and to life remains the same.
I have in my house two pillows that my sister made out at Petty Point. One says done, and the other one says next. When you've had a bad experience, get it out of your body and your head and go on to the next thing, because there is always a next thing. I'm hoping that will be on my tombstone. My sister has promised to do it, and it will say done next.
For The Takeaway, I'm Alexandra Boti.
The documentary about Marcia Nassiter, A Classy Broad, Marcia's Adventures in Hollywood, is touring film festivals around the world. You can see a trailer and find out more about the film and Marcia's life by visiting thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. After more than 17 months in detention, American college student Otto Warmbier was released from North Korea on Tuesday. It's quite unusual because this was a medical evacuation from the country. He was in a coma, said by North Korean officials, to be the result of botulism poisoning. Warmbier was serving a sentence of 15 years hard labor for allegedly removing a political propaganda poster from a hotel. Warm Beer's release leaves at least three remaining American detainees in North Korea: Kim Hak-song, who has been held since May, Tony Kim, who was detained in April, and Kim Dong-chul, arrested in October of 2015. Phil Robertson is deputy director of the Asia Division at Human Rights Watch.
Usually what we find is they are kept separate from others. They are kept in a way that, keeps them healthy, but of course keeps them isolated as well. And they're used as bargaining chips. And that's what we expected in this case. It's a classic indication of, you know, finding an American, hitting him with a trumped-up charge, giving him an excessive, abusive prison sentence, this in case 15 years of forced labor. And then, you know, ideally they would set up and sort of start negotiating. That didn't happen here. And so the question was why and what is going on behind the scenes.
Nevertheless, 15 years at hard labor is hardly a picnic, even if you are an American bargaining chip.
Well, he should have never been in prison in the first case. You know, this was a college-style prank. At most, they should have perhaps fined him and held him for a day or two to sort of impress the seriousness of the matter and then sent him back. You know, the North Koreans just took advantage of a situation, took advantage of a young man's mistake and, again, you know, really made him pay for it. It's an indication that North Korea, you know, is willing to abuse human rights in pursuit of its political agenda in almost all instances.
And I think they've demonstrated that again and again. I think the question here is, what sorts of diseases can you get if you're sentenced to hard labor in North Korea if botulism is in fact involved here? And what does that say about the other people who are still detained?
Well, I'm no medical expert, but there's already a lot of experts saying that it's hard to imagine how he would have gotten botulism. What we've seen in cases of North Korean citizens is that when they are detained in these kind of situations, they're almost always tortured brutally. And so the question is whether, for some reason, something went awry here. Was he beaten in custody? Was he somehow abused? And we're just not going to know until we actually get a clear indication from his family and, of course, from the doctors in Cincinnati. I think that what we've seen, however, is that North Korea, has abducted foreigners. It has abused its citizens. At the end of the day, the human rights issue has to be at the center of the international community's dealings with North Korea because human rights abuses are a central part of the way that this government maintains power over its people through fear, intimidation, and abuse.
Finally, what can you tell us about this unusual university that is a private educational institution in North Korea?
Well, yeah, we're talking about the Pyongyang University of Sciences and Technology. It's very interesting because this is a Western-funded educational institution that is catering to the absolute elite of North Korean society. This was set up in 2010. It's supposed to be the way that North Korea catches up with the world. And it has a number of foreign lecturers, including people from America. And what we've seen in the last year is that two of these professors, one Kim Song-duk and the other one Kim Hak-song, have been detained in North Korea, again, based on allegations that they're involved in spying of some sort. So North Korea, I think, is perhaps having either second thoughts about, you know, having this foreign education targeting their elites because they brought that in, but now these people have been arrested, or, you know, perhaps they somehow are hyper-defensive that somebody's trying to get to their elite group and, try to turn them away from the regime of Kim Jong-un.
Phil Robertson is Deputy Director of the Asia Division at Human Rights Watch. Thanks so much, Phil.
Certainly.
In modern warfare, it's not so much boots on the ground as it is the buzzing of lethal drones in the air. This past Sunday, the U.S. military confirmed that it carried out a drone strike in southern Somalia against the militant group Al-Shabaab. It's the first drone strike in the country carried out by the Trump administration under new, broader authorities for such strikes, granted by President Trump in March. If true, the report is part of a small minority of publicly disclosed drone strikes. In the 15-year period between 2002 and 2017, the U.S. government has disclosed only about 150 drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, out of perhaps 700. A new report called Out of the Shadows is a comprehensive review of the past 15 years of numbers, disclosures, and shifting legal justifications for for the government's increasing reliance on its drone program. Alex Moorhead is director of the Counterterrorism, Armed Conflict, and Human Rights Project at Columbia Law School's Human Rights Institute. He co-authored this study, which shows how much drones have changed warfare since September 11th, 2001.
What happened after 9/11 was George W. Bush said that we have a war on terrorism and we have to fight and everywhere around the world, and these people are enemies everywhere. And that had a number of implications. That resulted in things like Guantanamo, but it also resulted in the US saying they had an authority to kill anyone in the world, anywhere. And for some years, in the early years, that was this policy of carrying out so-called targeted killings in places like Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen. It began increasing over the years. And I think one of the reasons why it increased was because they developed the capability to do so.
And the government reports what percentage of these drone strikes and how many were you able to actually report on?
Yeah, and this is probably one of our chief concerns, because what we were doing in the report, this was a joint report that we did with the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies, which is a Yemeni think tank with offices in Yemen, in Beirut, and in the United States. And they have firsthand experience of the direct impact of drone attacks on communities in Yemen. And our focus really was on looking into the element of secrecy and transparency, because this was a very controversial new policy that the US government launched, but it was even more controversial because it was so secret. For many years, we did not know anything about this program. We didn't know, the US government would not admit that strikes were occurring. They would not explain why they were doing it or what legal grounds they had to do it. They were not explaining whether civilians were killed or whether they were getting the right people, you know, in their view. And this was one of our big concerns. And so we reviewed to see how secret is the government in this regard and how transparent has it been.
How much would you say this has changed during the new Trump administration?
Well, I'd like to maybe take a step back as well, because there was another really big concern that your listeners may be interested in, which is, you know, when civilians are killed, they look for answers. And that's fair enough. You know, it's very worrying. You don't know what's happened and why. But when you have, in the few cases where Western civilians have been killed, there was a case of an American and a Pakistani civilian accidentally killed in a strike in Pakistan in 2015, that received a presidential apology, a public acknowledgement by the president and the press secretary and everyone. There was, you know, online you can find like a 40-page press briefing explaining what happened, why, that we're going to look into this and see what we can improve and so on. And they promised to pay compensation. And that's all right. You know, that's what should happen when civilians are killed. But what's worrying about this is there is a gross disparity between how Western civilians have been treated and the hundreds of civilians that independent organizations have been reported have been killed in these strikes in Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen, who are local, and they have not received the same treatment as this American and this Italian civilian. And that's something we really are calling on the government to remedy.
In Yemen and Somalia and other places around the world where drones are used extensively, what's it like to live where the skies are an enemy?
I think the many people that talk about this, they live in constant fear of the buzzing of the drones. They don't know when it might happen, because when you live in such a place, you can hear the drone, but you can't see it. And that can be a very unnerving thing when you have relatives who have been killed and you have people, you know that this has happened before. You don't know where they're going to strike. And where you know that people that have been targeted, you don't know why they've been targeted, because you know that they weren't involved in anything and they were civilians. And I think that's very concerning. And bringing us up to the present day, you know, thinking about under Trump, you know, it's early days to assess what the new administration's record on this, but there are already some concerning signs. One is that so far, if you measure the number of strikes that the Trump administration has carried out in Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen, it's running at four times the monthly rate that Obama was running at, which is significant. Plus, you have these specific incidents, and I'm sure some of your listeners may be aware of a disastrous ground raid, a lethal operation in Yemen in January that resulted in a number of civilians dead, including reportedly an eight-year-old girl. And I think when you have this mix of increased activity, also reports that the administration is looking to loosen the rules to make it easier to carry out these types of operations, it makes transparency even more important. We should know what's happening, why, what legal grounds they have to do this, and there should be absolute clarity about what measures are being taken to protect civilians.
The brutal, frightening, transformative impact of drones in warfare. Alex Moorhead, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alex Moorhead is director of the Counterterrorism, Armed Conflict, and Human Rights Project at Columbia Law School's Human Rights Institute. Imagine knowing almost nothing about some of your family members, other than they were famous the world over. Imagine as a young girl collecting every story you could find about these mysterious family members. Ginger Shankar's mother died at 35 when Ginger was just 9 years old, and she set out to find out how her mother and grandmother's lives as women in India were different from her own. Ginger was a musician, so were her mother elders, Viji and grandmother Lakshmi. She learned quite a lot from interviews and photographs from performances of her mother and grandmother. Now imagine if you had a special voice to tell people these stories of your family. Well, don't mistake this sound for a track from some hip lounge. This is the Shankar Family Story, a multimedia piece called Nari. Ginger, you see, was born into a renowned musical household. Many people know her legendary great-uncle Ravi Shankar's immortal pieces and performances and for his collaborations with the Beatles. When it came to composing the score for Nari, Ginger's previous work writing for films, Charlie Wilson's War, Passions of the Christ, served her very well. Music and pictures, she says, go together.
To be inspired by images and write to that, first of all, is so different than anything I do. You know, usually you're just thinking of a song, but to see images, it takes your music in a very different way. And it becomes so exciting to sort of bring characters to life. But then the other side of that is, you know, you write the most beautiful piece you ever thought, and right, the director goes, you just trampled all over my dialogue. And you go, oh my God, there was dialogue?
You know? Yeah, where's the cowbell?
Exactly. Yes. So you realize that you also have to like give space to what's happening.
Yeah. Well, collaboration.
Exactly.
Is collaboration a part of this family project?
It definitely has been a collaboration. I think it started with my grandmother giving me these scrapbooks and starting to dig into history. And the collaboration started with me being in India and just starting to interview people and hearing the stories. But then it became much bigger than that, because as I started performing it, and I told people I didn't have pictures of my mother, I didn't have pictures of my grandmother from certain eras, people that come to shows would come up to me after and say, you know, hey, I saw them in 1974 in Toronto at the stadium, and I have pictures that I'm going to send you. Or, oh my goodness, I saw them here, and here's some video. And it started as a family scrapbook for my own self, you know, but it's been the most collaborative, beautiful project, because people remember these shows that well. Mm-hmm. And they have had all this film sitting somewhere, you know.
Well, that's the technological piece of what you're doing that intrigued me. And it seems to me that so many people post-partition mm-hmm. have used technology from India or Pakistan to preserve a life that came before, whether it's pictures, sound. I mean, I know so many people from South Asia who have kept recordings and yeah. have old reels or reel tapes and this dorky stuff, but they love it. And, you know, where it's much more of a geeky thing in the United States, it feels intuitive mm-hmm. As you think about preserving history.
Absolutely. Some of the earliest recordings of incredible Indian musicians that I wanted to study are all on cassette tapes when they went to people's houses. Even on this project, one of my really good friends who I grew up with, his parents met my parents, I think, in the 70s, and they used to go to all these concerts. So they used to have cassette tapes running when they would sit and have tea. So I've heard recordings of my mother sitting and having tea and talking, which I'd never heard before. And they have recordings of them playing at Santa Monica Pier. It's just such a constant thing of these recordings, and there is such a history because of that. And we're so lucky to have that. Nowadays, you'd think about it and go, whoa, that's weird that somebody's recording you. But it was always that of, like, mm-hmm. in case somebody starts singing, in case somebody gives a lesson, and all the stuff is recorded in somebody's living room somewhere. It's really amazing.
What stories have you heard from your family that have kind of shocked you? Have you done any oral history on this?
I've done quite a bit, actually. My grandmother's sister, who's still alive, who's in Madras, I asked her a lot of questions because the family doesn't talk about certain personal things really openly with us children. But it was really interesting to hear. A lot of her stories were about how she traveled with Ravi Ji and Alareka when they first were bringing Indian music after Woodstock to all these different places, you know, and she told a story about how they were in Brazil for the first time about to play an Indian classical concert. And they were at this really crappy hotel and they're carrying all their heavy sitar and tambura and tabla. And they realize, you know, the room is like 25 floors up with no elevator, you know, and you go, oh my God, just thinking about the idea of being in a new place. And then you go, oh God, I have to carry everything upstairs, you know, and she had 100 stories like that. I'm sort of an annoying child. I always was. My grandmother complained that I used to ask her so many questions and she'd always pawn me off to the next relative being like, go ask them something. So over the years, I've recorded so much of her history and my family's history. And that's sort of how this happened too, because I'm such a curious, curious kid. I always have been.
Is this the Shankar narrative that is most important here, or is this a symbol of what all families may have using these tools that you've used?
I think the symbol for this really is the women in families and sort of how women in general take care of families, they build families, and they kind of fall into the shadows. I think everyone has a mother or a grandmother or a great-grandmother that can kind of really relate to this, you know, that they are the silent ones that really push families forward and take care of everybody.
Are there pieces you have yet to climb on the violin? Any thing you'd love to do with your band that, you know, expands even the ambitions that you've already experienced?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the projects I always choose are the ones that really scare me. And that's how I know I'm doing the right thing. If I go, oh, this could be easier. Oh my God, how am I going to do that? That's the one. So there are some really classical pieces I'd like to do with the band after this project is done and kind of like bring Indian music in a different way to the forefront, because we've been doing kind of more Western classical meets Indian with strings and electronics. But I would like to do like a full-on Indian classical album with classical guitar and violin and pick some really difficult pieces to do.
You know, what do you think the coming together of all these sounds? I mean, world music was a bin at mm-hmm. Virgin yeah. Records, you know, for so long. But now it's something different. What do you think it is?
It's interesting because in India, the bad word wasn't world music, it was fusion. Everyone was doing fusion, you know? And now I think what's really beautiful about that term, because we all kind of shrunk away from it for a long time going, oh God, don't call us that, you know, because you just think it's like African thrown on top of Indian with some beats and like that was world music for about 20 years. But I think now what's really beautiful is people are so authentic with where they're coming from and the world is a melting pot. So it's not I'm doing Indian music and you're doing Western. Like people are actually learning each other's music and it's a very different way, you know, because even my music director, for example, is of an Indian background, but has studied Western classical music and studied jazz. And you can hear the influence of those things without forcing it, which is really beautiful.
Ginger Shankar is a singer, violinist, multi-instrumentalist and composer. Her latest work is Nari, the unsung story of the women from India's first family of music. It's a multimedia project. Ginger Shankar talks about women building families all over the world, and that's certainly true. We've also been talking about women in male-dominated industries, like Marsha Nassiter, the woman who first took the title of VP of production at a major Hollywood studio. What's your story?
This is Bailey from Allen, Texas. So I didn't work in a male-dominated industry, but in high school I was in ROTC, which was definitely a male-dominated environment, and made a lot of interesting experiences. We, as like the females in ROTC, faced overwhelming sexism and discrimination sometimes in everything from workouts to assignments. And a lot of people in my class knew I was a feminist and constantly taunted or made fun or made cracks and jokes at me.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And thanks as always for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. LegalZoom.com, helping Americans plan for their family's future with estate plans that include legal guidance provided through LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway. Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Staples. Staples offers copy and print solutions for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at Staples.com. Staples. It's pro time.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.